Welcome back to this wonderful global community we have built through the Global and the Granite State, a production of the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire. If you are a first-time listener, welcome to your go-to source for deep dives into current global issues that you need to know about. As always, my name is Tim Horgan, and I am the Executive Director of the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire, a nonprofit centered in New Hampshire and at the forefront of global conversations. For those who don't know, WACNH is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to helping people better understand the world. As a nonprofit, we rely on the generous support of our members, donors, and sponsors to continue bringing valuable and insightful discussions that will make your friends say, "Wow, how do they know that?" As we look to sustain our programs you love, like this one, I want to take a moment to shout out our podcast sponsor, McLean Middleton, a longtime friend of the organization. McLean Middleton is one of New England's premier full-service law firms with over 100 attorneys throughout offices in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. McLean Middleton's attorneys have been providing trusted legal services to businesses throughout the region for over 100 years. Learn more at McLean.com. Okay, now on to the show. Mind when you think of Haiti. I'm willing to bet that for most of you, this conjures up some catastrophe that has befallen this Caribbean island nation, whether it was the most recent assassination of a sitting president, or perhaps one of the several earthquakes to destroy major parts of the country's infrastructure, killing tens of thousands. Perhaps, for our younger audiences who are now just tuning into international news, as well as many others, it is visions of gangs terrorizing the population, overrunning the police, and breaking thousands of prisoners out of jail in a single weekend. But what if I told you this island was once home to a thriving economy, although under colonial rule? Also, it was one of the first colonial holdings to successfully break free from Europe, and they played a key role in ending slavery across the New World, as they supported independence movements across the region. So, how did this beacon of hope for a new, more enlightened world end up as a failed state that has not held elections in almost a decade? We spoke with Sophie Rutenbar, a visiting fellow in the Strobe Talbot Center for Security, Strategy, and Technology in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and a visiting scholar with the Prevention and Peacebuilding Program of the New York University Center for International Cooperation. That is certainly a mouthful and a lot to fit onto one business card. It is also important to note that, along with a number of other distinguished positions, she spent time in Haiti working for the United Nations Integrated Office, meaning she has firsthand knowledge of the issues facing this nation.
It's important to note just the deep history of Haiti in the region. I mean, it's one of the places that sort of apocryphally Christopher Columbus visited on his early voyages, and colonization started there quite early.
So, in order to understand how any country has gotten to where it is, we need to understand how it started and what factors influenced its development. Since we want to remain a podcast that everyone can feel comfortable listening to, we will keep some of the more graphic parts of its history on the down low. But I feel it is important to make clear that the reign of the Spanish and French was a brutal one, especially for the native people who lived there before first contact with the Europeans.
Early colonizers took advantage of the indigenous population, the Taino and the Arawak, enslaved them and used them to mine gold, to run farms, and essentially just between the hard labor and the disease imported by colonizers, that population was essentially wiped out quite early in the 1600s. And so then Haiti was a fertile place. Christopher Columbus apparently described it as just like completely verdant, covered in forests, just a really beautiful country, these mountain-covered islands. Then the question was, if you have this incredible natural resource in the minds of the colonizers, but you need a population to do your work for you, where do you get that from? The slave trade was huge in Haiti. I think by the time of independence, there were well over 500,000 slaves in Haiti. And that's to compare with a population of really only about 30,000 non-African slaves. And those were free people of mixed race and the plantation owners and the French colonizers in the country. All this massive importation of slave labor and combined with the natural fertility of the island meant that Haiti was, for a long time, the most prosperous, the most valuable colony of all of France's colonies in the New World, bringing in massive flows of money to the host country, to France, in terms of coffee, in terms of sugar, in terms of agricultural imports that really made Haiti the jewel in France's colonial crown.
Coffee, sugar, and indigo were the main exports from the colony, which of course required a lot of labor in very hot and unfavorable conditions. When you have a large population that is kept from sharing in the wealth, with not much to lose and a desire to be free of oppressive regimes, particularly distant ones, it is a recipe for revolt. So, in reality, the more things change, the more they stay the same when it comes to Haiti.
You get a situation where you have an enormous population that's really in pure misery, really working very hard, backbreaking labor, very, very low life expectancy. And then you have an extremely disproportionately small colonizing class. You're setting yourself up for disaster from the point of view of the colonizers. By the early 1790s, I mean, there had been efforts earlier in Haiti's history over the 1700s of the slaves to get free. There were individual slaves who were able to flee to the mountains. Haiti has incredible geography that's really shaped the history of the country. It's just extremely mountainous. There's a great deal of deforestation now, but for a long time it was just covered in forest. And these slaves took up residence in the mountains and were able to form units or form groups called Maroons that fought back against the colonial government. And so by the early 1790s, you have a pretty explosive mix. You've got a revolutionary government in France that's espousing all these ideals of liberté, fraternité. And you have these colonies in the Caribbean that really clearly are very not living up to these ideals. And then you have economic issues going on in France. France is seeking to pull back a little bit from some of its colonial possessions, its presence overseas. And you have a growing population of mixed race individuals in Haiti who are really seeing the bankruptcy of this system. They're born of, you know, enslaved individuals and colonizers or the enslavers, and sometimes are free, sometimes are freed later, sometimes are forced to continue to work as slaves. And they see the system for what it is. And I think one thing that's important to remember in terms of kind of looking at Haiti's situation these days is a lot of that energy towards revolution arose from those sorts of class conflicts. So was the mulattoes, the affranchis, wanting to claim their full rights, wanting to be named as citizens of France, the mother country, wanting to have the ability to grab all the advantages that they see the French colonizers in the country holding. You have a pretty explosive mix in the early 1790s. This all starts to unravel. There's a series of uprisings, violent uprisings. France, under Bonaparte, is trying to figure out what to do. And they actually outlaw slavery in 1793. For a while, this balances things out. And there are different concessions made, but it's really not a stable configuration.
In 1803, France breaks the armistice that it had signed a year earlier with the self-proclaimed Governor General for Life, Toussaint Louverture, and reinstated its own rule over the island. The battles for independence, led by Louverture's lieutenants, most notably Jean-Jacques Dessalines, are bloody and inflict heavy costs on both sides in terms of lives and treasure. At this point, France is starting to reconsider its holdings in the quote-unquote New World, as signaled by the Louisiana Purchase, completed by the United States in 1803. Then,
in January 1804, Haiti receives its independence after a critical battle, the Battle of Vertière in northern Haiti, where Haitian troops so resoundingly defeat the remaining French forces that there's a moment in the battle that people say of where the French have to pause and honor just the incredible military school of the Haitians that they're fighting against.
With the French removed from power and this country getting onto its feet, many are excited about the future and their ability to chart their own course. But as we will see over the next 200 plus years, things have not turned out the way many had hoped.
So you have this newly independent country in 1804. There's the idea that everyone starts over new and afresh, but all the issues that were challenges in 1803 and all the days leading up to 1804 are still there. You have a highly stratified society with wealth and education concentrated at the top. You have a pretty poor and very uneducated mass of the society, and you have color divisions that, to a certain extent, parallel this sort of stratification of wealth and education. You also have a country that isn't used to self-government and has to figure out how to do that. So, for a while, there's a division in Haiti. The north is ruled by an individual, Henri Christophe, who declares himself king. The south is ruled by a president. The country itself is trying to sort through things and figure out where it wants to go. It's pretty obvious that Haiti, as the first Black independent republic, was not greeted with much welcome by its other countries in the region and its mother country.
Of course, a slave revolt that leads to a prosperous nation was viewed by the colonial powers as a potential rallying cry for the millions of slaves still under the thumb of their masters across North and South America. The powers that be certainly did not want to have their own slaves attempt to overthrow the system that had treated the powerful so well. And colonial powers did not want to see their colonies declaring their own independence, regardless of who was declaring it. Therefore, you see the key players in the international space not exactly helping this fledgling country figure things out and create a path towards prosperity.
The key other countries, the United States, other colonizing powers in the region, really view the Haitian Revolution as a threat and really want to do what they can to try and prevent the Haitian Republic from being a success. And different countries took different strategies in regards to the Haitian Republic. The United States kept it very much at an arm's length, took pretty disadvantageous trading approaches with Haiti for a long time. Did not actually even acknowledge or recognize Haiti as an independent country until 1862, of course, which is in the middle of the Civil War by Lincoln and very much part of the political efforts that Lincoln was taking to defeat the South and reunify the Union. France, on the other hand, really very much felt the kind of economic loss of its prize jewel, prize colony, and it reached out quite early after independence to argue that it should be compensated by the Haitians for the loss of its property. And this went back and forth. The Haitian ruler in the south of Haiti, I mentioned that Haiti was divided for a time after independence. The Haitian ruler in the south of Haiti was open to paying an indemnity to France. The Haitian ruler in the north rejected it. Finally, in 1825, after the death of the Haitian ruler in the north, France reapproached Haiti, sailed into Haiti with a fleet of ships, 500 cannons, basically holding Haiti hostage, making that threat of force very, very clear if compensation was not paid for the French debt. So the French demanded a really astronomical indemnity from the Haitians for not pursuing the claim of regaining its former colony. They demanded 120 million francs. At the time, even the first payment of five payments towards that 120 million francs was more than the entire country's revenue for 1 year. So you're really looking at just an astronomical price put on a very poor and very fledgling country. And Haiti did not have the ability to obviously pay this debt. So it took out loans. Where did it take out loans from? Of course, French banks. The French banks had a field day with that debt, charging incredibly high, exorbitant interest rates, which just caused the total debt payments of the Haitian debt to far exceed the initial demand of 120 million francs to about five times the original amount. It took 7 decades for Haiti to pay off this debt, and the debt ended up amounting to about $560 million in today's currency. So huge in light of Haiti's current GDP. And when you consider that if this money had stayed in Haiti, had been part of the Haitian ecosystem and fueling infrastructure development, agriculture, schools, the value of that total amount is more about $20 billion that Haiti lost as a result of this French power play against its fledgling republic. Haiti was very much treated by different countries in the region for many, many years as a bit of a bargaining chip. That was even a role in the Haitian independence itself. At different points, Haiti saw support from the British, saw support from the Spanish against the French. There was never a move by different regional powers to view Haiti as a sovereign and independent country on its own.
Despite not having the respect and support of the international powers of the time, Haiti did take a positive approach to its relations with its own neighbors, leading the ways towards supporting independence movements and the abolition of slavery in multiple new countries.
You do really laudably see Haiti engaging in revolutions in Latin America, abroad. I think Haiti was the first country to recognize the independence of Greece, and there's still a strong Greek-Haiti tie. And so Haiti took very seriously its position as the first and really the only republic to gain its independence from slavery and tried to behave in a really responsible and generous manner towards its fellow free states in the region and the world. And in the return, you see how it's continually treated as a second-class republic by the big geopolitical powers at the time, and they sort of look for ways to continually undermine its development and its progress.
This included a requirement by the Haitian government that any revolution they were going to support would commit itself to ending slavery in the newly formed governments. Haiti was also the first nation to permanently abolish slavery and to recognize it as a crime against humanity. Despite multiple coups, changes in government, and new constitutions, the total ban on slavery has remained a constant. Another major constant for this country is that nothing remains constant and change is inevitable. Again, at one point, this land created the highest profits of any colonial holding and was blessed with many wonderful natural resources. If you look at its neighbor, the Dominican Republic, which it has a shared history with, you can see the path to success that Haiti could have pursued, despite the challenges. However, for a variety of reasons, the development of these two countries has diverged significantly. It is important to understand the geographical and weather-related challenges that has plagued this country from the start.
Haiti was blessed with incredible soil and wonderful weather and a very advantageous location and the transportation hub of the Caribbean. But it's also on a fault line, actually on more than one fault line. It's also directly in the path of the annual hurricanes that sweep across the Atlantic from Africa up to over to Central America and north to North America. And it really is just on almost a regular clockwork basis, Haiti is hit by a natural disaster. The earthquake in 2010 was by far the worst in definitely living memory. It led to well above 150,000 dead. There are estimates that are much higher. It really just devastated the capital, Port-au-Prince. To a large extent, I think Port-au-Prince has not fully recovered from that earthquake. A lot of the economic activity of Port-au-Prince moved from the downtown, where all the government ministries were, where the National Palace was, courts, businesses. All of that activity has basically moved out into the suburbs, up the hills, parts of downtown Port-au-Prince that have still not been rebuilt, most notably the National Palace. So, this incredible symbol of Haitian independence and Haitian pride. The 2010 earthquake was the most notable. That's what gets on people's radar, but it is part of just a series extend beginning before and kind of extending after of natural disasters. You have different hurricanes that have happened. You had Hurricane Matthew in 2018. You had another earthquake in 2021, which was in the south of Haiti, but that also killed about 2,500 people and led to the displacement of about 500,000 people. So every year when I was living in Port-au-Prince, people get to hurricane season and sort of brace themselves. And then if it, doesn't really lead to much, then you sort of breathe a sigh of relief at the end. But the country does not have the level of resilience. And there are real strong efforts by Haitians and the Directorate of Civil Protection and other government institutions to try and prepare the country for just the inevitability of natural disaster. But given the poverty of the country and given the current political and security situation, it is just incredibly difficult. And so that layered on top of everything else, the political dynamics, the history makes things very hard.
Okay, in the interest of time, we are going to skip a lot of history here and bring things to the modern day. Suffice it to say that of the 64 heads of state, both elected and unelected, Haiti did not see a peaceful democratic transfer of power until 2001, with René Préval earning the distinction of the first elected and second overall person to leave office at the expiration of his term. This unstable history certainly continues to haunt the country today as we see an unelected head of state in the wake of the former president's assassination, continuing to delay elections for a number of reasons.
Another parallel between Haiti and the Dominican Republic is both that had dictatorships for an extensive period of time during the Cold War era. However, the dynamics of Haitian politics and Dominican politics meant that to a certain extent, the Dominican government arrangement during that time led to progress in some development indicators. I mean, obviously, it was quite brutal and there were significant crackdowns on freedom, whereas the Haitian dictatorship saw real degradation over time in terms of development indicators. And so by the time you reach the end of the Duvalier dictatorship in 1986, you really have a situation where the country needs to reconstitute itself. And what I would argue is that we're here at this point in 2024 at a moment where the transition from the Duvaliers is still not completed, is still ongoing. So you have a constitution that has clear imperfections. Everyone agrees there needs to be constitutional reform. You have a real division in the country. You have just a complete breakdown in political consensus that again has its roots back in the 1990s and the 2000s and the divisions between, you know, what are considered left and right in Haiti. So there's a gradual erosion over time of the political framework that allows Haitian government and governance to operate. And so by the time you get to Moïse, you've just got a complete breakdown in political dialogue. So Moïse was not able to appoint a prime minister for months and years before his assassination. He was very much isolated and on his own. And you had, at the same time, a real rise in gang activity. So I think for a long time, gangs had been seen as the political pawns of certain politicians and certain business interests. And more in the years preceding Moïse's assassination and subsequently since the assassination, you've seen these gangs grow in power, grow in ability to match and even beat significantly by a large margin the Haitian National Police. At the moment of Moïse's assassination, you had the country in a really difficult position. Since the assassination in July of 2021, those difficulties have only exacerbated.
At 1 a.m. on July 7, 2021, a group of gunmen stormed President Moïse's house, beat him, ransacked his home, and killed him. They also shot his wife, who, interestingly enough, is now indicted in the plot, leaving her for dead. Their daughter survived the attack by hiding in a bathroom, and none of his guards put up much of a fight. This is a long and convoluted story of why this took place, but it seems to have been led by political rivals who were convinced that they were the next leader of the country and that Moïse needed to be removed. It is unclear if the original intention was to assassinate the president or just remove him from power, but what is clear is that the final order was given to kill him and ransack the house, with a lot of attention paid to a purported list of important people in the country with links to drug traffickers and gangs. This case is still not resolved, and only a few people have been tried. Of course, this threw Haiti into an even deeper political crisis, and the situation has only deteriorated since then for the people of this country.
We're now in a moment where the homicide rate in 2023 was double the previous year. The number of kidnappings was almost double the previous year. You just have huge spikes. You have recent violence in the streets where gangs are, you know, no longer competing with each other for contracts and territory, but actually joining together and combining to take down government infrastructure and to exert control over what is the heart of Haiti, which is the capital of Port-au-Prince. So we're really in a pretty dire situation. And there's concern that there's no real sense from the Haitian government that they are able to take the steps that they would need to take in order to address the situation and bring things back in a better direction.
In recent weeks, the gangs have attacked critical infrastructure, broken over 4,500 prisoners out of jail, although, interestingly enough, those who are charged in the Moïse assassination have voluntarily stayed in jail, and the gangs have posed an overwhelming challenge for the National Police. Throughout all of this, the country has been led by an interim prime minister who had been named to the role by Moïse in the weeks leading up to his death, but had not been confirmed in the role. However,
he was intended by Moïse to form a national unity government to prepare elections because elections had not been held on time. There are currently no elected officials remaining in all of Haiti, and there have not been any for a couple of years. So Henri was elected with this kind of consensus mandate with the intention of bringing people together. He was seen as a figure with ties to certain parties that made him potentially someone who could produce this consensus. There was a lot of back and forth in the weeks after Moïse's assassination, since Henri was never formally sworn in, about whether or not to move forward with Henri or to move forward with some other governance arrangement, for example, the previous prime minister. The international community and certain members of the Haitian political class thought it best to move forward following what seemed to be Moïse's vision of creating consensus and moving towards an election. However, we're now 2.5 years later, and Henri has not been able to garner that consensus and do the basic steps of moving towards an election. At first, there was considerable opposition from different parties. There have been a couple of agreements formed that some steps have been made towards implementing them, but they've not in the end been implemented. And so we're in a situation now where the last of those two agreements has expired. Many people see that there's nothing really legitimately keeping Henri in office other than the fact that he's in office. So Henri has consistently promised to organize elections. He's consistently said he will not run in elections. But the thing is, at the same time, it's obvious that he benefits from being in office. It's a powerful position. Why would he leave when there's no alternative? And when some of the reason why elections haven't been held is because the opposition won't agree, and not just his own intransigence. So we're in a situation now where, you know, there's been recent, real recent unrest that was triggered by the announcement at a major regional summit last week that Henri would try again to organize elections, or would promise to hold elections by August of next year, August 2025. This just triggered sort of an outpouring of anger on the part of the population, on the part of different armed groups. So the fact that this person who has not succeeded in doing what he promised to do in 2.5 years has made almost no steps towards elections, who has more and more operated at a remove from the Haitian population. He rarely speaks. There have not been major policy decisions coming out of his administration, except for those that would help to keep him in power. I think he really has lost legitimacy among Haitians. I had someone tell me during my most recent visit there that he is the most hated person in the country, not just disliked, hated. And so there really is a sense that on the one hand, you have international partners who just want stability in Haiti. They just want to kind of not have to worry about Haiti given other geopolitical crises that are happening around the world. But on the other hand, they see transitioning from this really seemingly illegitimate administration to another administration as a real risk for instability. So they want elections. They want things to just go forward and to not have to worry. But it doesn't seem like that's possible anymore. It's hard to envision that after 2.5 years, that the next year and a half towards elections in August 2025 are going to be much different, that there's going to be much progress made, that security is going to magically appear. And so we're in a situation where, you know, there's just very little hope among the average, you know, among Haitians for, you know, any sort of improvement coming out of the current political situation.
Of course, as mentioned throughout this conversation, one of the big reasons for this instability is the power of gangs to really take on the national police and win. In many cases, they are better funded, better equipped, more motivated, and simply more capable than the police. Many of them are actually made up of former disgruntled police officers. So they have an intimate knowledge of police tactics, which they can then use against the police. We have seen the destruction brought by these gangs, the fear that the general public live in each day, and the inability of the national government to really do anything about it. In response to this, the international community has committed to helping Haiti tackle this problem of instability. But not much has happened in the recent past to act on that. This is also complicated by the numerous past interventions by the international community that have either not succeeded in bringing long-term stability or actually flat out made things worse. But when the other option is doing nothing, something does seem like the better choice.
The acting Prime Minister Henri requested outside support for the Haitian National Police all the way back in late September, early October 2022. And the country at that time was in a period of serious civil unrest. There had been price hikes in terms of gas. There was incredible gang activity that led to basically the country's main repositories of fuel being completely shut off for about 2 months. Things were just at a standstill. Like, schools were not open, cars were not moving because they didn't have fuel. In this sort of very dire situation of unrest and the gangs exerting their influence and trying to bring the government to its knees, Henri asked for international support. It's telling just to remember that this happened in October 2022. We're now in 2024. So the conditions have not gotten much better in Haiti. There's been ups and downs, and violence has shifted in different parts of the country and different parts of the capital. But essentially, what it boils down to is that the Haitian National Police are very much outmatched by the gangs. The Haitian National Police are quite small. They're insufficient in size to handle the policing needs of the capital, much less the country. They are getting smaller even by the day. There have been huge departures from the police overseas with the Biden parole program, just police getting fed up and leaving. There's incredibly low morale. They're outgunned by the gangs. The gangs are much better funded, much better armed, to some extent, maybe even better organized. So I think there's even among my friends who are most regretful at the idea of another international intervention, it's hard to for them to imagine how security could be restored given the incredible weaknesses of the Haitian National Police and the strengths of the gangs. The question is, what's the way of doing that? And international partners with the US in the forefront were very much looking for a way to respond to Henri's request to support the Haitian National Police for a number of months. And so finally, Kenya stepped forward last summer. They offered to support their brethren in the African diaspora. And yeah, there's a whole bunch of kind of complicated things behind Kenya's interest in that. But they offered to lead the force, which is really this kind of critical role of how do you coordinate these capacities and bring people together and set a strategy and implement. That was agreed back in the summer. The Security Council of the United Nations endorsed that in October again, a year after the original request. It immediately ran into roadblocks in terms of the Kenyan court system. And in the meantime, things are getting worse and worse in Haiti. And there's more and more dissatisfaction with Henri as this latest political agreement that he had created expiring without any sort of follow-on. You've got essentially with the Kenyans, they have offered to, in addition to leading the mission, to provide 1,000 police. And then you have contributions from other countries. Benin recently came forward and offered 2,000. So you have, in essence, a few thousand, maybe 5,000 at most, police who have been offered to come in and support the Haitian National Police by protecting critical infrastructure and by providing operational planning and support. Whether that's going to really fix the situation and address security is really, it seems doubtful. There may be some gains. It's not nothing when you have 10,000 Haitian National Police and you've got 5,000 new police officers deployed along them. But Haiti has a long history of intervention by different countries, including by United Nations peacekeeping missions. And those peacekeeping missions were considerably larger. The most recent real peacekeeping mission was MINUSTAH. When they started back in 2004, they had 6,700 military and 1,600 police, so already well above the Kenyan numbers. And things were not as bad in 2004, actually, believe it or not.
It is worth noting here that the United States has committed to providing financial support, but will not agree to send any of its own people to help stem the violence. Of course, with funding for Ukraine and Israel held up in the House of Representatives, it is not clear that even this monetary support for the mission would be forthcoming. Canada balked at an international pressure campaign to lead this force, and no major power has put much effort into figuring out how to solve this issue. As violence has ramped up in the past few days and weeks, Henri has finally agreed to step down as prime minister once a transitional council is put in place and an interim leader is selected. Hopefully, this will help quell some of the violence, as Henri's resignation is one thing being called for by gang leaders, but it is hard to believe that these gangs will just stop the violence to allow for free and fair elections anytime soon. However, all does not seem lost, and there are some glimmers of hope.
I do see hope. I mean, I wouldn't be working on Haiti if I wasn't inspired by the work that Haitians are doing and those who are committed to their country and care deeply about it. And I think that's where my hope comes from, is the Haitians who are still in Haiti, the Haitians in the diaspora, the rich cultural and intellectual heritage of the country and the people who are carrying that forward. And I think from the cold realist kind of international relations point of view, there is hope. Haiti is in a position where it could offer favorable trade arrangements with neighboring countries, be a destination for tourism, be once again an agricultural hub in the region, with the appropriate agricultural input. So the hope is that we can just find a way, politically speaking, to allow the country to move beyond this current stalemate. It's really that stalemate that preventing all these action being taken that could bring all these other positive aspects of Haiti into play and allow the country to sort of move forward and move towards getting back on the right foot.
I want to end today's conversation with the why this should and does matter to everyday US citizens. It goes beyond the appeals for humane conditions for people to live in and all around the world, and that no one should have to live in a country that is so out of control. This is true here, as well as in places all across the world. But there are economic, migration, and political reasons that this matters to everyday people in the US.
The US absolutely has an interest in stabilizing Haiti. I mean, what's top on maybe the minds of most average Americans is the immigration situation. And Haitians make up a huge proportion of those who are trying to get in the country. They're one of the top four groups crossing the Darien Gap. There were 500,000 people who crossed the Darien Gap last year to venture north. We've seen in the past, in other periods of destabilization in Haiti, boats of refugees or those seeking refuge leaving Haiti and trying to travel to Florida. The US, in a situation of global contestation where things are more challenging than ever before, and the US is having to look abroad to protect itself, the US needs to make sure that its backyard is stable. And I think the important thing to note is that stability cannot be imposed. It's a false stability, it breaks and it cracks. And so stability needs to be reached by working with Haitians to reach a sustainable government situation that is reflective of their needs and priorities, not just something that is a patch that allows people to kick the can down the road.
Without a doubt, the challenges that face Haiti today are not going away anytime soon, unfortunately. Their historical roots run deep, and the experiences of past interventions make Haitians and the international community alike hesitant to bring in this multinational force. Despite this, we should not take this as a call to do nothing, but rather to do better, to build alongside the Haitian people, to help them build towards success, and to learn from past mistakes. Of course, as a nonpartisan organization, we are not here to give you the answers or direct you in your own decision-making on how to engage with this crisis. However, the one thing we always promote is that you make your own voice heard on this issue. Talk with your community, lead factual conversations with those who have different ideas, share this podcast with those who need to hear it most, and talk with your elected officials on what you think the best path forward is. Thank you for your time and engagement with this important conversation. This has been The Global in the Granite State, a podcast of the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire. I appreciate everyone taking the time to become more informed global citizens and to join us as we position our global community at the forefront of international conversations. Thank you to everyone who supports this important work. Tim Horgan is your host, researcher, producer, director, audio engineer, fact checker, marketer, fundraiser, and whatever else needs to get done to make this podcast possible. It is certainly a passion project, and I hope you enjoy these conversations as much as I do. Please send us your feedback to council@wacnh.org. Until next month.